The Worm Ouroboros by E.R. Edison. Chapter 1. The Castle of Lord Juss. Of the rarities that were in the lofty presence chamber, fair and lovely to behold, and of the qualities and conditions of the lords of Demonland, and of the embassy sent unto them by King Gorais the 11th, and of the answer thereto. The eastern stars were paling to the dawn as Lessingham followed his conductor along the grass-walk between the shadowy ranks of Irish yews that stood like soldiers, mysterious and expectant in the darkness. The grass was bathed in night-dew, and great white lilies, sleeping in the shadows of the yews, loaded the air of that garden with fragrance. Lessingham felt no touch of the ground beneath his feet, and when he stretched out his hand to touch a tree, his hand passed through branch and leaves as though they were unsubstantial as a moonbeam. The little martlet, alighting on his shoulder, laughed in his ear. "Child of Earth," she said, "dost think we are here in Dreamland?" He answered nothing, and she said, "This is no dream. Thou, first of the children of men, art come to Mercury, where thou and I will journey up and down for a season, to show thee the lands and oceans, the forests, plains, and ancient mountains, cities and palaces of this world Mercury, and the doings of them that dwell therein. But here thou canst not handle aught, neither make the folk aware of thee, not though thou shalt thy throat hoarse. For thou and I walk here impalpable and invisible, as it were two dreams walking." They were now on the marble steps which led from the yew walk to the terrace opposite the great gate of the castle. "No need to unbar gates to thee and me," said the martlet, as they passed beneath the darkness of that ancient portal, carved with strange devices, and clean through the massy timbers of the bolted gate, thickly riveted with silver, into the inner court. "Go we into the lofty presence chamber, and there tarry a while. Morning is kindling the upper air, and folk will soon be stirring in the castle, for they lie not long abed when day begins in Demonland. For be it known to thee, O Earthborn, that this land is Demonland, and this castle the castle of Lord Juss, and this day now dawning his birthday, when the demons hold high festival in Juss's castle to do honor unto him and to his brethren, Spitfire and Goldry Blushko. And these and their fathers before them bear rule from time immemorial in Demonland, and have the lordship over all the demons." She spoke, and the first low beams of the sun smote javelin-like through the eastern windows, and the freshness of morning breathed and shimmered in that lofty chamber, chasing the blue and dusky shades of departed night to the corners and recesses and to the rafters of the vaulted roof. Surely no potentate of earth, not Croesus, not the great king, not Minos in his royal palace in Crete, not all the pharaohs, not Queen Semiramis, nor all the kings of Babylon and Nineveh, had ever a throne-room to compare in glory with that high presence-chamber of the lords of Demonland. Its walls and pillars were of snow-white marble, every vein whereof was set with small gems, rubies, corals, garnets, and pink topaz. Seven pillars on either side bore up the shadowy vault of the roof. The roof-tree and the beams were of gold curiously carved, the roof itself of mother-of-pearl. A side aisle ran behind each row of pillars, and seven paintings on the western side faced seven spacious windows on the east. At the end of the hall, upon a dais, stood three high seats, The arms of each composed of two hippogriffs wrought in gold, with wings spread, and the legs of the seats the legs of the hippogriffs. But the body of each high seat was a single jewel of monstrous size. The left-hand seat, a black opal, a sparkle with steel-blue fire. The next, a fire opal, as it were a burning coal. The third seat, an alexandrite, purple like wine by night, but deep-sea green by day. 10 more pillars stood in semicircle behind the high seats, bearing up above them and the dais a canopy of gold. The benches that ran from end to end of the lofty chamber were of cedar, inlaid with coral and ivory, and so were the tables that stood before the benches. The floor of the chamber was tessellated of marble and green tourmaline, and on every square of tourmaline was carven the image of a fish, as the dolphin, the conger, the catfish, the salmon, the tunny, the squid, and other wonders of the deep. Hangings of tapestry were behind the high seats, worked with flowers, snake's head, snapdragon, dragon mouth, and their kind. And on the dado, beneath the windows, were sculptures of birds and beasts and creeping things. But a great wonder of the chamber, and a marvel to behold, was how the capital of every one of the 24 pillars was hewn from a single precious stone, carved by the hand of some sculptor of long ago into the living form of a monster. Here was a harpy with screaming mouth, so wondrously cut in ochre-tinted jade, it was a marvel to hear no scream from her. Here, in wine-yellow topaz, a flying fire-drake. There, a cockatrice made of a single ruby. There, a star-sapphire the color of moonlight, cut for a cyclops, so that the rays of the star trembled from his single eye. Salamanders, mermaids, chimeras, wild men of the woods, leviathans, all hewn from faultless gems twice the bulk of a big man's body, velvet dark sapphires, crystallite, beryl, amethyst, and the yellow zircon that is like transparent gold. To give light to the presence chamber were 7 escarbuncles, great as pumpkins, hung in order down the length of it, and 9 fair moonstones standing in order on silver pedestals between the pillars on the dais. These jewels, drinking in the sunshine by day, gave it forth during the hours of darkness in a radiance of pink light and a soft effulgence as of moonbeams. And yet another marvel, the nether side of the canopy over the high seats was encrusted with lapis lazuli, and in that feigned dome of heaven burned the 12 signs of the zodiac, every star a diamond that shone with its own light. Folk now began to be astir in the castle, and there came a score of serving men into the presence chamber with brooms and brushes, cloths and leathers, to sweep and garnish it, and burnish the gold and jewels of the chamber. Lissome they were, and sprightly of gait, of fresh complexion, and fair-haired. Horns grew on their heads. When their tasks were accomplished, they departed, and the presence began to fill with guests. A joy it was to see such a shifting maze of velvets, furs, curious needleworks, and cloth of tissue, tiffanies, laces, ruffs, goodly chains and carcanets of gold, such glitter of jewels and weapons, such noddings of the plumes that the demons wore in their hair, half veiling the horns that grew upon their heads. Some were sitting on the benches or leaning on the polished tables, some walking forth and back upon the shining floor. Here and there were women among them, women so fair one had said, "It is surely white-armed Helen, this one." this Arcadian Atalanta, this Phryne that stood to Praxiteles for Aphrodite's picture, this Thais, for whom great Alexander, to pleasure her fantasy, did burn Persepolis like a candle, this she that was rapt by the dark god from the flowering fields of Enna to be queen for ever among the dead that be departed. Now came a stir near the stately doorway, and Lessingham beheld a demon of burly frame and noble port, richly attired. His face was ruddy and somewhat freckled, his forehead wide, his eyes calm and blue like the sea. His beard, thick and tawny, was parted and brushed back and upwards on either side.
"Tell me, my little martlet," said Lessingham, "is this Lord Jus?"
"This is not Lord Jus," answered the martlet, "nor aught so worshipful as he. The lord thou seest is Vol, who dwelleth under Cartadza by the salt sea. A great sea-captain is he, and one that did service to the cause of Demon-land and of the whole world beside, in the late wars against the ghouls. But cast thine eyes again towards the door, where one standeth amid a knot of friends, tall and somewhat stooping, in a corselet of silver and a cloak of old brocaded silk, coloured like tarnished gold. Something like Tavol in feature, but swarthy, and with bristling black mustachios.
"I see him," said Lessingham. "This, then, is Lord Jus."
"Not so," said the martlet. "'Tis but Viz, brother Tavol. He is wealthiest in goods of all the demons, save the three brethren only, and Lord Brandok the Ha."
"And who is this?" asked Lessingham, pointing to one of light and brisk step and humorous eye, who in that moment met Vol and engaged him in converse apart. Handsome of face he was, albeit somewhat long-nosed and sharp-nosed, keen and hard and filled with life and the joy of it.
"Here thou beholdest," answered she, "Lord Zig, the far-famed tamer of horses. Well-loved is he among the demons, for he is merry of mood, and a mighty man of his hands withal, when he leadeth his horsemen against the enemy." Vol threw up his head and laughed a great laugh at some jest that Zig whispered in his ear, and Lessingham leaned forward into the hall, if haply he might catch what was said. The hum of talk drowned the words, but leaning forward, Lessingham saw where the arras curtains behind the dais parted for a moment, and one of princely bearing advanced past the high seats down the body of the hall. His gait was delicate, as of some lithe beast of prey newly wakened out of slumber, and he greeted with lazy grace the many friends who hailed his entrance. Very tall was that lord, and slender of build like a girl. His tunic was of silk, colored like the wild rose, and embroidered in gold with representations of flowers and thunderbolts. Jewels glittered on his left hand, and on the golden bracelets on his arms, and on the fillet twined among the golden curls of his hair, set with plumes of the king-bird of paradise. His horns were dyed with saffron, and inlaid with filigree work of gold. His buskins were laced with gold, and from his belt hung a sword, narrow of blade and keen, the hilt rough with beryls and black diamonds. Strangely light and delicate was his frame and seeming, yet with a sense of slumbering power beneath, as the delicate peak of a snow mountain seen afar in the low red rays of morning. His face was beautiful to look upon, and softly colored like a girl's face, and his expression one of gentle melancholy, mixed with some disdain.
but fiery glints awoke at intervals in his eyes, and the lines of swift determination hovered round the mouth below his curled mustachios.
"At last," murmured Lessingham, "at last, Lord Jus."
"Little art thou to blame," said the martlet, "for this misprision, for scarce could a lordlier sight have joyed thine eyes. Yet is this not Jus, but Lord Brandok the Half, to whom all demon-land west of Shalgreth and Stropardon oweth allegiance. The rich vineyards of Crothering, the broad pasture-lands of Faelza, and all the western islands and their crag-bound fastnesses. Think not, because he affecteth silks and jewels like a queen, and carrieth himself light and dainty as a silver birch-tree on the mountain, that his hand is light, or his courage doubtful in war. For years was he held the third-best man-at-arms in all Mercury, along with these, Goldry Blushko and Gorice the Tenth of Witchland. And Gorice he slew 9 summers back in single combat, when the witches harried in Goblinland, and Brandok the Ha led 540 demons to succor Gaslark, the king of that country. And now can none surpass Lord Brandok the Ha in feats of arms, save perchance Goldry alone. Yet lo," she said, as a sweet and wild music stole on the ear, and the guests turned towards the dais, and the hangings parted, "at last the triple lordship of Demonland! Strike softly, music, smile fates on this festal day! Joy and safe days shine for this world and Demonland! Turn thy gaze first on him who walks in majesty in the midst, his tunic of olive-green velvet, ornamented with devices of hidden meaning in thread of gold and beads of chrysolite. Mark how the buskins clasping his stalwart calves glitter with gold and amber. Mark the dusky cloak streamed with gold and lined with blood-red silk. A charmed cloak, made by the sylphs in forgotten days, bringing good hap to the wearer, so he be true of heart and no dastard. Mark him that weareth it, his sweet dark countenance, the violet fire in his eyes, the sombre warmth of his smile, like autumn woods in late sunshine. This is Lord Jus, lord of this age-remembering castle, than whom none hath more worship in wide demon-land. Somewhat he knoweth of art magical, yet useth not that art, for it sappeth the life and strength, nor is it held worthy that a demon should put trust in that art, but rather in his own might and main. Now turn thine eyes to him that leaneth on Jus's left arm, shorter but mayhap sturdier than he, apparelled in black silk that shimmers with gold as he moveth, and crowned with black eagle's feathers among his horns and yellow hair. His face is wild and keen like a sea-eagle's, and from his bristling brows the eyes dart glances sharp as a glancing spear. A faint flame, pallid like the fire of a will-o'-the-wisp, breathes ever and anon from his distended nostrils. This is Lord Spitfire, impetuous in war. Last, behold on Jus's right hand, yon lord that bulks mighty as Hercules, yet steppeth lightly as a heifer. The thews and sinews of his great limbs ripple as he moves, beneath a skin whiter than ivory. His cloak of cloth of gold is heavy with jewels, his tunic of black sendaline hath great hearts worked thereon in rubies and red silk thread. Slung from his shoulders clanks a two-handed sword, the pummel a huge star-ruby carven in the image of a heart, for the heart is his sign and symbol. This is that sword forged by the elves, wherewith he slew the sea-monster,
as thou mayest see in the painting on the wall. Noble is he of countenance, most like to his brother Jos, but darker brown of hair, and ruddier of hue, and bigger of cheekbone. Look well on him, for never shall thine eyes behold a greater champion than the Lord Goldry Blushko, captain of the hosts of Demonland. End of chapter 1A.